Thank you all for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. So as was noted, I'm here on behalf of the Ad Council, but really in partnership with Sea Change. And hopefully many of you are familiar with Sea Change. If not, I encourage you to become familiar with them. They're a great organization, really focused on eliminating cancer as a health issue in the U.S. here. And they do that by bringing in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors to collaborate around cancer issues, help accelerate progress, fill unmet needs. And one of those areas that they're focusing on, which I've had, again, the privilege of supporting and working on through the Ad Council and also personally, is an effort that I'm going to talk about today, which is encouraging a national shift from focusing our energies and attentions on a treatment-based cancer approach to one that focuses on prevention and early detection, which I'm sure all of you can agree is one that we need to spend some time on. And hopefully after hearing a little bit about the work they're doing, you can get more engaged with Sea Change. And I'll point out my colleague, Payal Shah, who's here in the audience, who will, in addition to myself, be glad to talk to you afterwards. So the three areas I just want to focus on this evening is first to talk a little bit about some research that we did in 2008 with consumers, and then more recent research with executives, business executives, 300 business executives to be exact, of companies of $1 billion in revenues plus, as well as some formative research we did with policy leaders. I'll talk a little bit about the current knowledge and beliefs around cancer prevention specifically, highlight some promising communications approaches that we think can benefit all of our organizations across sectors, and then lastly highlight some messages that we found to work and that we were able to quantitatively test. So just to jump right in, older adults, I think a lot of this won't be a complete surprise to many of you if you're working in the communications field, but it's often helpful to sort of see this down and solidify with some quantitative data. Generally, older adults are more receptive to cancer prevention messages than younger adults, and I think the reason for that in many cases is because they're more health aware, typically have one or more health issues, whether that's, you know, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. So they're more receptive to messages about cancer prevention in general. Doesn't mean you can't message to youth, it's just a little bit more challenging. The public overall has a general awareness of what it means to be healthy, right? It's eating right, being physically active, don't smoke, but they're really cloudy on sort of the details and what does that mean and how much do I have to really engage with this. And clearly there are lots of barriers to adopting a healthy lifestyle, whether it's lack of time, the stress in their daily lives, they're not well informed or they don't know the latest data or information, they lack the monetary resources or the insurance coverage. They also, in general, and when I say they, I mean we, frankly, lack confidence in the information and a lot of the data that's out there. I'm sure you guys can all agree that, you know, 1 week a study will say that, you know, coffee, 3 cups of coffee a day will help reduce the incidence of some sort of cancer. A few weeks later, there'll be a study refuting that or saying something different where it actually promotes the onset of cancer. So it's difficult for consumers to really understand who it is they should be trusting and what directives they should follow. And then overall, cancer in and of itself is not very well understood. So the public tends to have an awareness of the link between smoking and lung cancer or sun exposure and skin cancer, but a lot of the other cancer issues in between are, again, very cloudy. Awareness of cancer is universal, but it's not always personally relevant. How does this apply to me? Is often a question that we heard. And there's a lack of understanding between the relationship of diet and physical activity in cancer. Again, there's that smoking and lung cancer relationship, but diet and physical activity, there's a lot of opportunity to message in those areas and relate it not only to heart disease, heart health, and other health issues, but really tie it to cancer and cancer prevention. And then lastly, which is probably obvious to many of you, screening is not really a message that's always relevant to younger audiences because oftentimes they don't fall into the category where the screenings are recommended. So it's something that's sort of pushed off for a later time. The last sort of knowledge and belief category that I think is really the most impactful and really where we took our direction in developing some messaging approaches has to do with this entrenched belief that cancer just somehow happens to you, right? It's sort of like rolling the dice. no matter what you do, at the end of the day, there's a good chance that I may get cancer. And, you know, we heard personal stories. Everyone has a story of, you know, an uncle, a grandfather, a cousin who, you know, smoked every day and was, you know, drank every day and was unhealthy and lived to 95 and, you know, died of natural causes. And even though that's just a one-off case, people tend to internalize that and personalize that and sort of figure, well, it's sort of up to chance. And they often challenge this notion that cancer is preventable. So the simple language that we all tend to use around prevention, which we know is possible, most people tend to reject. We know that people are hearing messages. There are a lot of messages out there. Majority have heard something about cancer prevention, whether it's tobacco messages 9 and 10, diet and nutrition 8 and 10, screening 7 and 10, and to a lesser extent, physical activity messages. And most believe it is, in fact, important to reduce their risk for cancer in some way. 8 and 10 agree with that statement. The troubling part of it is that less than half surveyed really know of ways to reduce their risk. So it's important, but they don't really know what to do about it. Few have discussed ways to reduce their risk with a healthcare professional, only 3 in 10, and even less have sought out online resources or toll-free numbers. A lot of the communications programs that my organization and others like it tend to promote, there's less and less people actually seeking that information. So with that knowledge base, what are some promising approaches? How can we address this? Well, first and foremost, it's really just a slight shift, but, you know, language is very important. It's going from talking about prevention to risk reduction. This idea that we can prevent something, avoid it altogether, is not something that necessarily resonates, but the fact that you can take some steps to reduce your risk, right, essentially improve your chances, add a loaded dice, let's say, to that roll, is something that people will believe. And then going one step further, the ability to provide individuals, the public, business leaders, policy leaders, with simple, small things they can do to help support that risk reduction also goes a long way. It sort of takes that bigger, you know, the big C and brings it down to something that's a little bit more manageable. When specifically talking to business leaders and getting them to adopt this risk reduction or this prevention approach, you know, it's important to focus on the benefits to that particular company, that organization, or their constituents, right? So the idea of preventing cancer sounds good to everyone, but on a daily basis, what does that mean for me, my organization, my constituents? It's important to emphasize health outcomes versus illness treatment, right? Again, that's the way that we typically talk about it. People know the negative outcomes, but how can we really shift that emphasis to providing for your employees, help them become better, more effective employees, help promote a healthier community versus avoiding some of the negative consequences. And then lastly, show them how you can really make the healthy choice the easier choice. And that's essentially what you want to do if you're a business leader or someone who's a leader in the community. Communications elements that work versus ones that don't, again, might not be completely newsworthy, but interesting to see it as it relates to cancer. Messages that are positive, inviting, and motivating clearly work much better. Talking to individuals as partners, as you know, as opposed to lecturing. Oftentimes, we may actually know better, but if you present it in that way, it will usually be a deterrent to most. Make sure the messaging is customized and personal, right? It's all about you and what can this behavior change, this policy do for you versus what can it do for this country or for, you know, individuals in general. And then lastly, in this category, you know, provide a way to empower whoever it is you're communicating to, give them some sense of control, versus talking in sort of a passive voice. I mentioned already the power of the simple change of risk reduction versus avoiding cancer prevention altogether. You'd be surprised how empowering this is. I'll talk a little bit about some data in a few slides. Small steps, right? These simple changes that you can make, again, whether it's simple policy changes, simple changes for your employees, or simple changes as an individual versus, again, avoiding the bad, the negative, the bad habits. And then lastly, use prescriptive language. Be very specific. you know, this idea of eating healthy or helping to promote healthy habits for your employees or for your community is too vague. If you want to go in there and promote, an environment of prevention and early detection, ask specifically what it is that you want them to do, whether it was an individual or another entity. So now sort of getting to some of the data, some of the messages that we found work based on some of those approaches. Overall, as I mentioned, risk reduction works across multiple audiences. So it's motivating to the individual. It's motivating to policymakers, business executives, and cancer leaders. What's also motivating is this idea of acknowledging personal responsibility. So you can go out there and promote a lot of policy change and community change, but at the end of the day, most leaders will say, well, there's some sort of personal responsibility that the individual needs to take. And that's true, and you need to acknowledge that. And all we can do in working with a lot of these groups is to create an environment, again, where you can help make the healthy choice the easier choice. So make sure we acknowledge that. For the public, we actually developed a communications architecture, a platform, and we tested a lot of these messages. These are just some examples of how it works, but for your organizations, if you're looking to message to the public, now this idea of leading with risk reduction, right, telling individuals that they can reduce their risk for cancer, providing a relevant proof point. So here's just one example. Research indicates that only 5% of cancers are hereditary, which means you have the power to do something about it. You can include other relevant statistics that you may have for your organization or your particular cause. But then explain to individuals, you can, in fact, reduce your risk and there is something in your control, and then tell them specifically what that something is they can do, whether it's in the diet, exercise, smoking, or screening arenas. Just some of the data, and I'm happy to share some of the studies with you, but 9 in 10 consumers found that message to be believable and important. 8 in 10 viewed the message as personally relevant. Again, one of the problems that we see, that cancer isn't personally relevant. 7 in 10 made them feel that they could actually succeed in reducing their risk. So again, this idea of being powerless was overcome by some of these messages. And then 6 in 10 said they would share the message with friend and family. So again, the ability to share that on beyond themselves. For executives, again, the survey with 300 executives, risk reduction was clearly the preferred approach versus prevention. Again, their individuals, just like the general public, that idea resonated with them. 8 in 10 preferred that versus the prevention approach. When asked to choose a series of ways to talk about risk reduction and what the benefit would be to them, 38% chose saving money for their organization as the most motivating. And behind that, I think at 22% was to provide a healthier, happier workforce. So clearly that bottom line is important to executives. And then lastly for executives, when we did a pre and post, so essentially we asked them some questions about what is your likelihood of either beginning to invest or continuing to invest in efforts to guard against cancer. Started out at 54% agreed that they were very likely to do so. After exposing them to these risk reduction messages, that moved to 61%. So small jump, but in fact, across the 300 sampled was a significant increase. And then lastly, among cancer leaders, this idea that more than 50% of cancer deaths are avoidable through risk reduction in these four areas were promising. So to the extent that communicating with cancer leaders, you can line up each of your efforts with one of these four and frame it as helping to reduce cancer deaths by 50% will go a long way with many cancer leaders, whether you're seeking funding or other efforts in the prevention and early detection arena. So with that, I'll say there's a lot more to this initiative. I encourage all of you to talk to me afterwards or talk to Pyle. You can also visit seachangetogether.org/risk-reduction for a lot more information. We're hoping to really bring everyone in on this to really shift that attention from one of treatment to prevention and risk reduction. And these are just a series of tools that many of you can use freely, and the data is also there for you to use. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Anthony. Can I have all the presenters come up front And we can open it up to discussion. Questions from the audience? Yes.
So the question was whether in looking at overutilization of mammography, whether I looked at cancer stage of these patients who are in this sample. I think I neglected to present in this study that I've excluded patients who were at stage 4 of breast cancer. So these were only women who were eligible for routine cancer surveillance, not women who already had advanced cancer. And also we've also excluded women who reported that they were told by their physicians in prior years that their cancer has metastasized or has spread to other parts of the body. So we are restricting the analysis to women who were diagnosed in the beginning with stages zero, either stages zero up through stage 3.
And
oh, yes. These recommendations are actually targeted at breast cancer survivors. So these are not recommendations for the general public. Women at average risk for developing breast cancer. And they came from all kinds of organizations, the American Society for Clinical Oncology, the NCCN, and also international organizations, the NHS in UK, and the NHRMC from Australia, and organizations from Canada and France as well. So it was a fairly extensive review of all these different guidelines, specifically targeted at routine cancer surveillance for breast cancer survivors, not average women. So it's fairly consistent that they recommend an annual mammography following their curative treatment once a year, and I don't recall from the review that there were any controversies in terms of the timing and the frequency for those cancer survivors. But for the average, for the women at average risk, yes, there's still ongoing controversy about when to start and how often and so on. Did that address your concern? Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Next question.
Oh yes. So, like the question, I had the same one, but the
sure.
Question is regarding the frequency at which the cancer mm-hmm. center or other oncologists actually contacted them, mm-hmm. Reminding them. So, did you control for that, or were the reminders sent out?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have information about how frequently their providers reminded them to come back for routine surveillance. Yeah, but that's absolutely an important factor to consider. Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have that data to try to control for it. We did try to control for one of the covariates that we included in the model was how likely they were to follow their physician's recommendations to come for testing. And but I don't think that directly matches what you were thinking about. Yeah, unfortunately. Right. Okay. Sorry. We don't have that.
Yes, over there. That's
really good question, because none of the pastors went through the support team member training, but there's training that's offered in the community, and so usually there's a leader, somebody who's in the health ministry in the church goes to the training, not the pastor. It's pretty rare that the pastor would go through that effort of going through the training, but they do sanction individuals in the church going through the training. So there's two different versions of the training. There's a support team leader training, like the person who's going to coordinate the team, get everybody together. That person can do a day-long training, and then everybody else who's on that team meets for a 2 to 3 hour training that talks about who's on your team, who's in the team, what are some of the things that some of the guidelines around being on a team, because as a team they don't give medications, they don't give money, they don't give any medical care, so they want to make sure that everybody has the same rules that they're abiding by, so that reduces conflict. And then they also meet once a month for either a 29 minutes or 59 minutes to coordinate care, to say this person that we're on a team for needs help going to the doctor these days, or they need help with meals, or we're helping that person with their garden, so they can kind of coordinate what's needed. And of course there are things that occur outside of that they communicate either by phone tree or email or other means, depending on what works better for that team. So Project Compassion is the name of the organization that has most commonly provided training for the support team model, and they provide training in our local community. They also provide training nationally. They'll go out to different places and provide that training.
I'm going to take my prerogative here and ask Katie a question. So you were talking about usability, and I was wondering, I don't think you said it, what the average age was of the people that were doing the usability testing, and then who's the age of your target audience here for these mobile design apps, and how does that compare to, that standard kind of cancer patient?
Yeah. So usability, the average usability participant, I don't know that we ran the actual numbers, but they're relatively young. These are people that we recruited Catch as Catch Can, and the participant or the user profile for mHealth TLC is definitely older, and so that's a gap. That plus the plus the lung cancer are two big gaps for us as far as usability is concerned. There was a little bit of usability still ongoing that included a trial with a man who was 71 that I don't have the data for yet. But that's just one data point. So yeah, we tried to recruit people who, regardless of age, were potentially maybe less media internet savvy, and we're not super successful with that, because that's another thing that we're thinking we're going to need to keep an eye on as well. So yeah, totally aware.
Let me just add,
sure,
that half of our usability subjects were over 50, so we did recruit over 50, and we've done a lot of research in the area of gamification with older adults. And there's definitely a large movement toward older adults being receptive to working with a motivating gaming platform. So it was on that theoretical basis and on some research done, but not a lot, with older adults that we are moving forward. And our next level of usability is going to be with the chronically ill, and then after that we're going to do it with lung cancer. But we really want to get all of the kinks out before we work with lung cancer patients. And tomorrow I meet with Lung Cancer Alliance from Lafayette, and they've been very open to recruiting patients for us to work with. We're very excited about the possibility of getting something that will help with communication and
clinicians. Any more questions from the audience? Okay, well, with that, we'll end. Thank you. I want to thank all of our presenters.